women equal rights with men as well as social positions. The right to learn, the right to work, to participate in political events are just few to count. In Islam, the woman enjoys full political rights except nomination to the post of the head of the state and judge, which are exclusively reserved for a man. She may even be a minister, a parliament deputy, and may manage other diverse political posts. This is exactly what the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran demanded. So we as women should try our best to perform our role in the growth of the Islamic society. Thank you very much for being with us, and I really hope that you have enjoyed this episode. Until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
The limelight.
The Zionist regime's allies aren't just turning a blind eye to Gaza's killing fields. They have cheered on the bloodshed, provided diplomatic cover, and supplied the arms. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, the Zionist regime is urging Western states to rally to its side as the International Court of Justice prepares to hear South Africa's case that the Zionist regime is committing genocide in Gaza. Some 23,000 Palestinians are known to have been killed by the Zionist regime so far, a majority of them women and children, and many thousands more are believed to be lying under the rubble. Tens of thousands are seriously wounded. A majority of the population have lost their homes to the three-month bombing campaign. The Zionist regime has intensively and repeatedly targeted the supposedly safe zones to which it has ordered Palestinian civilians to flee. It has destroyed almost all of Gaza's infrastructure and is blocking most aid from reaching the enclave. Famine and disease are likely to rapidly increase the death toll. South Africa's 84-page brief argues that the Zionist regime bombing campaign and siege breaches the 1948 Genocide Convention, which defines genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. The Zionist regime expects support from Western capitals because they have nearly as much to fear from a verdict against the Zionist regime as Israel itself. They have staunchly backed the killing spree, with the US and UK in particular, sending weapons that are being used against the people of Gaza, making both potentially complicit. According to a cable from the Zionist regime's foreign ministry, leaked to the Axios website, the Israeli regime hopes that, given the difficulties of making a legal case in defense of its actions, diplomatic and political pressure on the court's justices will win the day instead. The Biden administration led the way in dismissing South Africa's detailed legal brief as meritless, counterproductive, and completely without any basis, in fact, whatsoever. That would sound patently ridiculous to Western audiences had they been provided with serious coverage of Gaza, but the Zionist regime has been heavily restricting access to the enclave while killing Palestinian journalists there at an unprecedented rate to stop their reporting. In addition, Western media are willingly and secretly submitting to an onerous Israeli censorship regime. The Zionist regime's strategic goal at the court, according to the leaked cable, is to dissuade the judges from making a determination that it is committing genocide. But more pressing is Israel's need to prevent the Hague court from ordering an interim halt to the attack. The Zionist regime's officials will argue, Axios reports, that its sustained assault on Gaza fails to reach the threshold of genocide, which requires creating conditions that don't allow the survival of the population together with the intent to annihilate it. The Zionist regime will try to convince the judges that it has been seeking to increase humanitarian aid to Gaza and minimize the toll on civilians. Its argument flies in the face of the evidence South Africa has amassed. Its brief contains 9 pages of declarations by the Zionist regime's leaders showing clear genocidal intent, including statements from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, senior figures in the cabinet, President Isaac Herzog, and many serving and former Zionist military commanders. Giora Eland, an advisor to War Council Minister Benny Gantz, has called the Zionist regime's goal, the creation of conditions where life in Gaza becomes unsustainable. A Zionist military spokesperson stated from the outset that the aim was to inflict maximum damage on Gaza. One of the provisions of the Genocide Convention is an absolute prohibition on incitement to genocide. The Zionist regime's most senior politicians and military commanders have indisputably breached that section of the convention. A letter to the Zionist regime's attorney general recently from a group of Israeli academics, lawyers, human rights activists, and journalists underscored that point. They warned that incitement to genocide had become an everyday matter in Israel. The letter added, "Normalized discourse which calls for annihilation, erasure, devastation, and the like is liable to impact the manner by which troops in Gaza conduct themselves. But dehumanization, the precursor to genocide, is not the only problem. The Zionist regime's prosecution of what it terms a war to eradicate Hamas has fully met with its own definition of genocide. Conditions that don't allow the survival of the population were already being created long before the onslaught the Zionist regime unleashed immediately after Hamas broke out from Gaza on October 7th. Mostly forgotten in the back and forth about what it is unfolding in the enclave is the context. United Nations officials warned nearly a decade ago that the Zionist regime's siege of Gaza, now 17 years in duration, was designed to make the enclave uninhabitable. In other words, the Zionist regime was precisely creating conditions that don't allow the survival of the population.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The International Court of Justice in The Hague has held its hearing to consider its provisional measures on a lawsuit filed by South Africa against the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. The case sets a precedent as the first at the ICJ relating to the siege on the Gaza Strip, where thousands of people have been killed since October 7. Pretoria accuses Israel of committing genocide in contravention of the 1948 UN Genocide Convention, which both South Africa and the regime are party to. South Africa alleges that the killing of civilians in large numbers, especially children, the expulsion and displacement of Palestinians en masse, and the destruction of their homes, then citing statements by several Israeli officials portraying Palestinians as subhumans.
Israel's conduct violates Articles 2A, 2B, 2C, and 2D of the Convention. The first genocidal act committed by Israel is the mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza, in violation of Article 2A of the Genocide Convention.
It's an application that's split into two sections. One is the intent to commit genocide, and the second bit deals with the actual acts of genocide. And many of international legal scholars and others have indicated that it's very difficult for Israel to effectively answer to these cases without having to concede that their actions are indeed in violation of the Geneva Conventions.
To be collectively punished, all constitute genocide and show proof of intent. Evidence submitted by South Africa says acts and omissions by Israel are genocidal in character because they are intended to bring about the destruction of a substantial part of the Palestinian national, racial, and ethnic group. This refers both to what Israel is actively doing, such as carrying out airstrikes, and what it is failing to do, such as preventing harm to civilians.
Gaza, which is one of the most densely populated places in the world, is home to approximately 2.3 million Palestinians, almost half of them children. For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea.
The suit also lists the blockade on food and the destruction of essential health services for pregnant women and babies as measures by Tel Aviv intended to bring about their destruction as a GRIB, the Organization of Islamic Countries, the Arab League, Iran, Bolivia, Colombia, and Brazil, and a number of other countries have also supported South Africa's decision to file the case against Israel. Iran has urged international bodies and agencies, including the UN Security Council, to adopt immediate and practical steps aimed at complete cessation of Israeli military strikes in Gaza.
For people of my age, we were brought up in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and to see them leading the charge against Israel was really poignant. So there's a lot riding on this. Obviously, the lives and well-being of people in Gaza, first and foremost, but international law itself is on trial here, and I think the court has to know that.
A separate case is continuing at the International Criminal Court. Both courts are located in The Hague, Netherlands. While the purpose of the ICJ is to resolve conflicts between political regimes, the ICC prosecutes individuals for committing crimes.
This could be a turning point. This could be a moment where the world rises up in one voice and says in very emphatic term that is supposed to embody justice and equality and the rule of law, that these actions by Israel amounts to genocide, torture, and something that we have not witnessed, really in the history of mankind.
Under international law, genocide is defined as committing one or more acts with the intention to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group.
There is also the clear pattern of conduct. the targeting of family homes and civilian infrastructure, laying waste to vast areas of Gaza, and the bombing, shelling, and sniping of men, women, and children where they stand, the destruction of the health infrastructure, and lack of access to humanitarian assistance.
The gruesome scenes of death and destruction in Gaza are a reminder that for Israel, violence is not incidental, accidental, or coincidental. It is part and parcel of its colonial policies. For decades, Israel has used disproportionate force and has carried out countless massacres against Palestinian civilians as a form of revenge and punishment. Most of Gaza's 2.3 million people have also been displaced since October 7, with aid agencies warning of famine risk amid mounting hunger. The 365 square kilometer territory.
Israel's conduct has been deliberately calculated to cause widespread hunger, dehydration, and starvation. Israel's campaign has pushed Gazans to the brink of famine. An unprecedented 93% of the population in Gaza is facing crisis levels of hunger, but removing the ability to distribute it through constant
has already been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. Recent UN General Assembly votes show that most of the international community is appalled by Israel's brutalization of Gaza, yet appears unable to act. Throughout the past decades, Israel has controlled the Palestinian territories in part to colonize them through hundreds of illegal settlements on stolen Palestinian lands, in part to hold their population hostage until their leaders accept its political dictates. The Israeli oppression of Palestinians had already witnessed a sharp rise under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition cabinet, which is composed of far-right Zionist parties that oppose Palestinian statehood and support the expansion of settlements in the occupied lands. Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe, it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean, so children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, Flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief, they were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
The World Health Organization has once again sounded the alarm on deepening humanitarian and medical crisis in war-torn Gaza. It has called on the international community to take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing Palestinians in the besieged territory. According to the latest WHO assessments, Gaza has 13 partially functioning hospitals, 2 minimally functioning ones, and 21 that are not functioning at all.
There are actually no functional hospitals left in the north. Al-Ahli was the last one, but is now minimal functional. Still treating patients but not admitting new ones, along with Al-Shifa, Al-Ada, and Al-Sahaba Hospital. So these hospitals are still sheltering also thousands of displaced people. At Al-Ahli, about 10 staff, all junior doctors and nurses, continue to provide basic first aid, pain management as much as possible, wound care, and trauma stabilization services.
The Nasser Medical Complex, which is the most important referral hospital in southern Gaza, is partially functioning. The world body has expressed concern about reports of residential areas being ordered to evacuate around the hospital, which are extremely concerning. According to WHO reports and eyewitness accounts, when military activities intensify near the hospital, ambulances, patients, staff, and WHO and partners are unable to reach the complex. The world body has also said that it is working to strengthen and expand the existing struggling health system.
WHO will keep striving to supply health facilities in the northern Gaza, but without fuel, staff, and other essential needs, medicines, medicines won't make a difference, and all patients will die slowly and painfully.
It has also expressed concern about the fresh wave of displacement of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, who have been pushed by Israel to move to further south. It says the displacement of people will further strain health facilities in the south, which are already struggling to meet the population's immense needs. The WHO statement read, "This forced mass movement of people will also lead to more overcrowding, increased risk of infectious diseases, and make it even harder to deliver humanitarian aid. Most of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are grappling with terrible injuries, acute hunger, and severe risk of disease." WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom has also repeated a call on the international community to, quote, take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing the population of Gaza. The remarks come a day after the WHO staff went on a high-risk mission to deliver humanitarian supplies to the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza and Al-Amal Palestine Red Crescent Society in southern Gaza. Both hospitals serve as shelters for displaced Palestinians seeking safety amid relentless Israeli bombardment. At Al-Shifa Hospital, a reported 50,000 people are sheltering, while 14,000 others are at Al-Amal.
Seeing children, women, young men, old men and women, people bleeding out. I, at the same time yesterday at Al-Aqsa, I saw a woman who had multiple gunshot wounds. An attempt was made to refer her, and she was referred back because she was bleeding so heavily. So, I mean, there's blood everywhere in these hospitals at the moment. We're seeing almost only trauma cases come through the door, and at a scale that's quite difficult to believe. It's a bloodbath, as we said before. It's carnage.
They have been injured and have been in the hospital for 10 days. As soon as the Israeli troops withdrew, I rushed to take them. As you can see, they suffer from total burns for no reason. They were left with no food or water and no care. There are other injured members of my family, but I wasn't able to carry them. After I arrived at the hospital, I witnessed massive destruction, an indescribable scene. Patients are scattered in every corner, beds are overturned, and medical material are damaged.
Comments come as Israel is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. From corpses lying unattended on the streets, to hospitals and schools reduced to rubble, to children made orphans and tens of thousands of people rendered homeless, the gory events unfolding in the besieged Gaza Strip since October 7 are a textbook example of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The death toll in the coastal territory since the Israeli regime launched its indiscriminate aerial and ground attacks nearly 3 months ago is now over 21,000, most of them children and women. Almost all refugee camps have been rendered uninhabitable due to random strikes, forcing the majority of the population to sleep under the open sky amid heavy winds and heavy downpours. The barbaric attacks were only meant to give an image of victory to its defeated army, which has only succeeded in killing unarmed civilians and destroying civilian facilities.
This is really the worst thing that U.S. and Israel could do to Palestinians. The genocide is... the heinous war crimes are gone unnoticed.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Modesty. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Appropriate modesty is a morality encouraged by religion. The Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, has said, "May Allah bestows His mercy on him who is modest to the Lord, and he must be, who keeps both his mind and stomach safe from sin, who remembers his being worn out in his grave, and he who reminds himself of being raised in the hereafter." Modesty is of two kinds, the Prophet of Allah says, the modesty of wisdom, which brings knowledge, and the modesty of foolishness, which brings ignorance. Modesty sometimes results in ignorance. That type of modesty must be avoided. For example, if you have a question in mind and you don't ask it from a knowledgeable person, this modesty will result in ignorance. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, said, "Impudence is the head of all evils. Impudence is the opposite of modesty and must be avoided by the believers." Modesty is a trait that if one carries it with themselves, they are respected in both the worlds. It's not just about the hereafter. even in this world, people who are modest, they deserve that respect and they receive that respect from their surroundings, from their friends, from their companions. So modesty is a trait in the Islamic moral system and ethical system of Islam, which is incumbent not just on women, but men also. If you're modest, you will get the reward of it. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of modesty, and Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, the fourth divinely appointed imam, has said, "A believer does not do any good thing to be seen, nor does he give it up for modesty." So apparently there are two extremes. One is that you perform something, so you're showing it off. And then there's another time that out of modesty, you refrain from doing a good act that you're able to do. You know, sometimes we don't do a good thing, thinking that we are being modest. This is the wrong understanding of the concept of modesty. In Islam, you know, modesty is not defined like this. And at times, we waste our good actions because we do it to show off. The fine line has to be considered very carefully. The fifth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, said, "Modesty and faith are tied up together. They are always to be found together." Similarly, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, has said, "Modesty is a sign of faith, and faith takes you to paradise. There is no faith for him who has no modesty. The head of morality is modesty. Do not abstain from learning because of modesty." And lastly, Imam Musa al-Qasim alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, has said, "Surely Allah has forbidden paradise to him who is impudent and abusive, who has no modesty, who cares neither about what he says nor about what is said on him." So brothers and sisters, remember, modesty is a very important moral trait in Islam, and it is something which decorates a mu'min and a believer.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Economic Divide.
The U.S. Israeli genocide war continues to claim lives. Meanwhile, Israel is unraveling on a variety of fronts. One of those fronts is the food industry. Israel is coming up short, especially when it comes to food items. Well, the Israeli Food Association has even described it as a crisis. Is it a crisis? And is it limited to just food? Hi, I'm Kaveh Tahweh. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program: the food crisis, food shortages are imminent, factories are in war zones, one of the reasons. And also, there's been a threat to supply chains. We'll tell you what type of threats. Then, look at the Israeli war costs, up to $269 million daily. $20 billion for the first quarter of 2024 is what's been predicted. And the total war cost still standing at about $50 billion. We're going to take a look at how this U.S.-Israel genocidal war is impacting the cash flow in Israel. And then another aspect not paid too much attention to, which should be, actually, and that is the U.S. assistance to Israel, $3.8 billion in military support. You have the $14 billion funding bill that has been passed but has not been dispersed yet, and also the lines of credit by the U.S. How important is that for a lifeline for Israel?
As Israel's genocidal war in the Gaza Strip continues, the regime has grappled with various crises, including food insecurity. The Food Industries Association of the Israeli regime has raised concerns about the possibility of a food crisis if the aggression continues. According to reports, officials of the association have requested an emergency meeting to discuss aspects of food security and the establishment of an emergency food stockpile. Israel is also facing a threat to the supply chains through Ansarallah operations against merchant vessels bound to the occupied territories through the Red Sea. The vulnerability of these supply chains raises additional concerns about the stability of the food distribution network. The growing cost of Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip has also raised concerns among regime officials. The onslaught on Gaza is imposing a staggering daily cost of $220 to $269 million on Israel, totaling nearly $18 billion thus far. According to some reports, if the war persists for an additional 5 to 10 months, the potential cost to Israel could soar to $50 billion, equivalent to 10% of the regime's GDP.
Time to find out what's been posted online on this. We're going to begin with a website that said shoppers empty supermarket shelves despite pleas not to let the war cause panic. Now, this happened during the beginning stages of the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. It said aisles display a marked lack of mineral water, for example, canned goods, potatoes, rice, pasta, flour, diapers, after official advice to stock up. The Ministry of Military Affairs, however, has said there were no shortages that would be expected. Of course, that is not how it transpired. Next, another website, Israeli Food Industry Group, warns of potential shortage due to the Red Sea attacks by the Yemeni army. Quote, there is a risk of food shortage in emergencies after threats in the Red Sea amid the current developments in the Gaza war. We call it the onslaught. Next, another website, Supply Chain Edge, Israel-Gaza War, risks for electronics and healthcare. S&P Global Analysis is what this entry was drawn in terms of its resources, and it said Israel's largest export lines included electronics, healthcare, and defense supply chains, which could face operational or logistics disruptions in the event of escalated conflict. And finally, what to know about the U.S. aid to Israel? 75 years of support is the duration of time, and the U.S. has contributed around $130 billion to Israel since its founding. That figure is obviously not accurate in terms of other sources to have cited larger U.S. assistance when it comes to Israel. Nevertheless, this particular entry cited that figure. Time now to introduce our guest for our first Q&A. Joining us is Dave Warren. Dave Warren is a political activist. Dave Warren, welcome to the program. Taking a look at the way that this onslaught is costing Israel, we're looking at anywhere between $220 to up to $269 million per day. And, of course, that does impact the GDP of Israel and the economy overall in more ways than one. The way that there's a budget shortfall and a deficit as a result of that is quite a shock for the economy. How do you think Israel is going to fare when it comes to continuing with these costs? Because this is going to continue for quite some time, it appears. Do you think that Israel can actually withstand this war or onslaught, I must say?
Well, when you break it down into sheer statistics like that, it seems like it's going to be an incredible feat for Israel to stay on their feet economically. And it's a tragedy when the figures of war are translated into losses of Palestinians and is reduced down to economic numbers in the first place. There's a much greater moral gravity to this problem that needs to be considered But to the extent that Israel can hold out, it remains to be seen. With this kind of cost per day, $220 million to continue this ground siege. And what I think is critical is for the United States, who is already in the transgressive state by being an accomplice to this genocide, if they continue to support Israel, then that's going to be the only way that they can economically see through this ground campaign of genocide.
All right, let me introduce our next guest, is Stanley Ezrael, who joins us. He is an organizer and researcher at the La Roche Movement. Stanley Ezrael, welcome to Economic Divide. I'm going to continue with the same train of thought when it comes to the costs of this war, or onslaught, I must say, for Israel. The figures vary, but if we're looking at $250 or $260 million per day, the Israeli economy obviously has taken an impact. And it's now a question of for how long can this go on? And that is something that is not being relayed by officials in charge. The ultimate question here is, do you think that Israel can withstand the costs that are incurring because of this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war?
I don't. Who told you they could withstand it? If they can't, they can't do that. What? And if you look at, you know, look at what Netanyahu and his so-called war cabinet have to say, how they are managing things, they somehow believe that if they keep at it, they can compel the United States and, you know, the other nations associated with NATO and so on to bail them out. And at a certain point, that's just, you know, not going to stop. It's not, you know, what they are doing is, you know, as I said before, totally wiped out Gaza. You know, the way that they're, you know, taking care of Gaza is they're killing everybody and shoveling dirt over their graves where they've destroyed their homes, their hospitals, and so on.
It's time now for the Infinite News section of the program. Again, a reminder, we have picked stories or news that's related to the U.S.-Israel genocidal war that have an economic impact, whether it's on Israel, the occupied West Bank, or on Gaza itself. First up, the sector in Israel which is the most important, and again, there's an update to it because the fourth quarter results have been in amid the war, which we call an onslaught with Hamas. Israeli startup funding has dropped to a six-year low. Investments in tech startups have slumped based on the last quarter, as I mentioned, of 2023, 46%, that's almost half, as foreign funds are shying away from reinvestment in local markets. The big question is, how long will they shy away from the tech industry in Israel? Next, Israel's economy as a whole. This entry caught our attention, economic impact of the Gaza onslaught, which they call war on Israel. The economy is facing a strain because the GDP has dropped. No surprise there. Now, this is the part that's interesting. Returning reservists to help the economy as the war looks set to last well into the new year. Think about that. They are withdrawing the reservists from their duty, the genocide that's taking place in the Gaza Strip, so they can participate in one form or another to Israel's economy. That's how bad the economy is doing. They have to pull the reservists off the battlefield. Think about that. Next up, another item that caught our attention, and this has to deal with Israeli withdrawals, where the units, again, as we just mentioned, which are being withdrawn from Gaza, is to mitigate the damage to Israel's economy from the war, which began on October 7th with they call it attacks. We call it the liberation that came from the Al-Aqsa flood operation. So two of these entries that are related to this returning reservist shows how badly, again, the Israeli economy is doing. And finally, the movement that's called Boycott of Israel is definitely having an impact. Many are wondering whether it does have an impact or not. But when you have a McDonald's CEO coming out and saying misinformation, as he calls it, about its stance on the Israel-Gaza war, we call onslaught, is hitting sales. So he's admitting to the fact that sales are taking a dive. He said several markets in the Middle East and some outside the region are experiencing a meaningful business impact because of the onslaught. That does it for the clips or news items that we picked for you.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for the in-depth section of the program. We are looking at the food industry in Israel in terms of the crisis that it is experiencing. At least that's what the Food Industry Association is saying. Instances of supermarket shelves being empty is one example. But is there really a crisis? And how deep is this crisis? Let's try to find out if we can answer you with those questions. First, the location of the Israeli food production facilities. In terms of the impact, 90% of them have been impacted. The reason, it's actually very logical, because they're located in conflict zones. In terms of the geography, they're in the northern and southern regions of occupied Palestine. So that obviously is a logical reason for them to be experiencing disruptions. Next up, let's take a look at the way that the impact fares out percentage-wise. Well, 90% of Israeli farmers have been affected by this. The impact on Israeli farmers is quite severe. When you take a look at the percentage of 90%, then the production overall has decreased 35%. And the ones that are on that fake border with Gaza, 70% of them have been affected and their production to have dropped. So again, these are severe numbers. Obviously, that points to the crisis mode that the food industry in Israel is. In terms of the way that the restrictions are in occupied Palestine, for example, 100 to 300 meters, this is only accessible on foot and also for the farmers. But when you have this onslaught going on, it's pretty dangerous. And then you have, for example, 0 to 100 meters of this no-go and high-risk area. Well, these are all, again, restrictions which for the farmers is hard for them to continue to generate the revenues that they have to from this. So this just gives you a snapshot in terms of the types of challenges that they face, used to face also, by the way, because the fighters from the Gaza Strip used to fire rockets into these particular areas. Then we're going to take a look at the food products themselves. Well, 75% is what has been recommended in terms of the Food Industry Association, again, as one of the sources, for the food products to be locally sourced. And if that is done, then it would mitigate the food crisis impact. So that would definitely, I guess, soften the crisis in terms of its impact and basically serve as a cushion if the food products were to be locally sourced. And then is what has been very effective, and that's Yemen's anti-Israeli moves when it comes to the Red Sea area, for example. They are targeting the Israeli-linked vessels. In case you don't know by now, that has been done on a rather large scale. As a result of that, supply chains for Israel overall have been impacted. The port of Eilat, for example, is almost non-functioning at this point. And, of course, the food distribution network has been severely impacted when it comes to the way that the Yemeni army has targeted the Israeli-linked vessels, something that's still ongoing. All right, so it's obvious that Israel does have a food crisis on its hands, but there are also other moves that are being made, which I'd like to ask our guests and find out what state that's in, and in regards lands. Let me bring back our guest Stanley Ezrall, who is an organizer and researcher at La Roche Movement, who rejoins us. Stanley Ezrall, welcome back to Economic Divide. We're looking at the Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is has ordered for Palestinian lands to be reclaimed, or should I say confiscated. What is going on there? Because I'd like to find out if he's making, confiscations of these lands in order to give it back to settlers, for example, or to pursue it with farmers. I'm trying to get an understanding of this, if you can help us out here.
What's going on in Israel is not that extreme, but they don't really have any way of preventing that kind of thing from coming to pass in the occupied areas of Israel. There are various things that they are doing, like, you know, they talk about their landholders, you know, the people that they are sending into the Islamic sections of the Israeli ground, Gaza, the West Bank, and so on. And this, Netanyahu administration has been quite open that if they want to take property, you have people who are Jewish, who are Zionists, who want to go into these areas and take property that others are living in, that is their right. And if you look at the kinds of things that Netanyahu has said publicly, for instance, go back to the September 23rd speech that Netanyahu made in person to the United Nations General Assembly, and it was in the range of about 8 pages. Approximately 2 or 3 pages of that were him discussing how it is that every Palestinian has no right, no sense of humanity, nothing else. All they think about doing is killing people. And what he concludes from that is that, well, if they're killing people, we should kill more people, right? That's what's been going on since then.
The aggression on Gaza and the retaliatory attacks by Palestinian fighters against the regime has also impacted various sectors of the Israeli economy, including tourism, the tech industry, and the construction sector, which are highly dependent on Palestinian labor force. There are now reports that Israel is planning to change its labor policy and import foreign workers from countries like Sri Lanka, India, China, and Thailand. The impact of the regime's budget, incorporating reduced tax revenue, has amounted to $19 billion in the fourth quarter of 2023 and is anticipated to rise to $20 billion in the first quarter of 2024. As 20% of the Israeli workforce is either unemployed or drafted, the Israeli economy is expected to see major hits in the upcoming quarter. Moreover, around 300,000 Israelis were drafted as reservists, 139,000 of whom were withdrawn from the workforce. This signifies the second largest reserve draft in the occupation's history, the first being during the Yom Kippur War.
Welcome to the Quick Take segment. I'm Matti Apusian. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip is costing lives, and it is costing the Israelis a pretty penny, or should I say shekel. As Israel continues its onslaught spending, how about the U.S. assistance? How instrumental is it to Israel's economy? Washington spends $3.3 billion annually in military budgets and an additional $500 million for Israel's missile defense. And more recently, the White House is pushing for $14 billion in aid to Israel for early 2024. From 2016 to 2020, the United States gave Israel $146 billion in military aid. not adjusted for inflation, according to Congressional Research Service data. And some experts estimate the total value of the aid adjusted for inflation to be $236 billion. But the U.S. is going beyond its military aid in order to save Israel's economy. This was evident in what the U.S. president signed in Israel before the year was out in 2023. The U.S. extended the terms and privileges of mutual trade free of customs for Israel, including many agricultural products. The U.S. extended this for 1 year until December 31st, 2024. According to the White House, this extension would provide additional time for the U.S. and Israel to replace the 2004 trade agreement and include the exchange of agricultural products between the two sides. A free trade agreement between the United States and Israel was established in 1985. The agreement abolished tariffs on most manufactured goods traded between Washington and Tel Aviv, but did not include Israeli agricultural products in order to protect American farmers. And then there is the U.S. loan guarantee to Israel. This is perhaps the most important means for Israel's economic survival, especially when it comes to continuing the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war to cushion the lack of cash flow. For decades, Washington has provided billions of dollars in loan guarantees to Israel. It was initially extended until fiscal year 2005, and since then, Congress has extended the program six times, running through the end of fiscal year 2028. The Israeli Treasury can use these loans if domestic and international unsecured bonds become expensive. That brings us to the end of this Quick Take segment.
Many economists have issued a bleak picture of Israel's economy. Things are so bad for Israel in terms of its economy that it had to actually call back some of its reserves. Remember, we had that in our Info News section. These are the reserves that were active duty. They wanted them to come back to help with the economy. Well, Israel depends on the U.S. Ultimately to bail it out. That gives U.S. leverage, however, over Israel, unless Netanyahu wants to save himself by continuing this genocidal war. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. Hopefully, we gave you some insight into Israel's economy in terms of how it's doing. From Yikov Tafoyi and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.